Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to Real Science Radio. I'm Bob Enyart.
And I'm Fred Williams, creation speaker and software engineer.
Fred, I have here in my hands, you do too, the latest issue of Creation Magazine. This is the fall issue of the 2016 series.
Yep, volume 38, number 4.
I just love it. These articles are so fun. And there's one on the brain, the human brain, and the power, actually the energy that we use to do all of our thinking.
Yeah, that's right. So this guy that works for IBM, he's the head of their advanced micro integration department.
Yeah.
He says that the brain consumes only about 20 watts of power, just 20 watts, which makes it about 10,000 times more energy efficient than the best silicon machines that we have today. And I know we spend a lot of money on power engineers whenever we develop a product. Power is really important.
You're not kidding. And data centers around the world, like run by Amazon, by Google, and so on, they consume about 2% of the world's energy. 2%.
Wow.
That's a lot. I like when they put them up like in Siberia or up in Norway where it's cold. They don't have to use so much air conditioning. Just seems smart. But this year, imagine all the computing power of the human brain. Some recent studies have said it's the equivalent of every device ever hooked up to the internet.
Yeah.
One human brain. I mean, it just gives you an idea of what it's like. It uses 20 watts of power.
Just 20 watts. That is so amazing.
Yeah, I just love it. In fact, the whole human body uses about a 100-watt bulb.
Yeah, yep. And the technology behind it is so impressive. I mean, I'm looking at your Note 7 right here. You know, this thing's been...
My Galaxy.
I'm waiting for this thing to explode.
You know, the Samsung Galaxy Note 7.
You haven't turned yours back in. You know, they're recalling all those things because the batteries
are
catching on fire.
Fred, I got the Note 7 the first day it was for sale at T-Mobile.
Well, when they said that was going to be a hot phone,
the
they weren't
day,
kidding. Sorry.
It's really fabulous, but they do tend to explode.
They have that tendency.
So, and I've flown a few times since I got that phone, and they do not allow you to use your Note 7 on the plane. But the weird thing is, I have already replaced mine. I got the replacement Note 7. But the thing is, the airlines can't tell a new replacement Note 7 from the original Note 7s.
So they didn't let you take it on.
Well, they let you take it on the plane. You just have to have it turned off.
Okay.
And, you know, you get a lot of work done on the airplane. And nowadays... Yeah. I just go right online, and it's even free with my mobile service. I get on that plane, and it's like I'm, you know, on the surface of the planet.
Yeah.
And somehow the airlines are going to have to figure out that hundreds of thousands of people have their replacement Note 7s.
Yeah.
But your point is that God designed the human brain. It works with just 20 watts of power. You know, I'm
continuously.
Waiting. Continuously. Just astounding.
Right? Yeah.
I'm waiting for a robot to run a 10K on 2 eggs, a slice of toast, and a glass of milk and go 10K.
Yeah.
And don't leak while you're running. That'd be so cool. And Fred, this is such a rabbit trail, but thinking of a 100-watt bulb, I did the calculation just before the show to figure out how many photons are released from a 100-watt bulb. And the number is astounding. The way God created the physical universe, it's in the quintillions per second. It's 300 quintillion photons per second. And, you know, you got 100-watt bulbs around your house. Maybe eventually you go to jail if you have them, but, you know, they've outlawed Freon. They've outlawed all kinds of stuff. But anyway, we look at a 100-watt bulb, and it helps us to see, and that's cool. Our eyes can handle that. But how about if you do 1/300 quintillionth of that light. And I'm talking about a single photon. You and I have reported for years that the human eye is able to distinguish a single photon.
A single one.
One. That's astounding.
It is. It's hard to comprehend.
And you got atheists like Richard Dawkins and so many others saying the human eye is poorly designed.
Poorly designed and backwards. Just a backwards design.
Yeah, right. How could you see less than one photon?
Yeah.
Right? It's a brilliant design. And for God to make us where we could handle extremely bright scenes. And that just recently they've redone the research with a very sophisticated technology to release single photons at a time. And sure enough, human beings are able to detect single photons.
Wow. Wow.
God is awesome. Okay. And the guy you mentioned, his name at IBM, he's a biologist.
Yeah, biologist. Bruno Michel.
I just love that they're studying God's design to figure out how to improve man's design.
Yeah, if you can have that kind of power rate in a computer chip, I mean, it'd be amazing. You know, everybody complains about, oh, man, my battery's dying. When we went to China, we bought those little extra battery packs. You know, you can buy, they look like little lipstick containers.
Yes. Yeah, you know? We use them, Cheryl and I.
And with this kind of power that they have here, it'd be 10,000 times more efficient. So we wouldn't need any of those.
No.
Because it'd last for months before you'd have to charge it.
Yeah, it'd just be so awesome, wouldn't it? So why don't you pick the next article out of this great Creation magazine?
Well, you know, there's these genes, and they're called HRV genes.
HRV genes.
HRV genes.
Not HRV like herbivores, but HRV with a V as in victory. HRV genes, but it doesn't stand for victory. These are like backward genes that are not supposed to do anything, right?
Yeah. So it's real interesting, their role that they play in pregnancy and how they help the formation of the placenta. And, you know, what's interesting about these genes, Bob? I mean, we've talked about HRVs for a long time.
Yeah.
It's an evolutionist, love them, right?
Yeah. Retrovirus is supposed to be chunks of your DNA that were transferred horizontally by a virus, and that they're just junk.
Yeah.
Junk. They just would be ignored, and literally they were ignored for decades because they figured they're junk. They have no function. Well, now that the whole junk DNA is passe,
that
the vast majority of molecular biologists in the working world of molecular biology, they don't talk about junk DNA.
No.
They look for function. And sure enough, in the journal Nature, 440 researchers around the world published, they have found function for 80% of the human genome. And the director of the project said he thinks it's going up toward about 100%.
Yeah, exactly. Heading towards 100%.
So slaughtering the whole concept of junk.
Oh, yeah. And you still hear the argument from evolutionists. They're just uninformed. And who knows how long that argument will last.
Because Darwinism is a science stopper.
It is. It's a religion. Yeah,
the theory of evolution. Yeah. Right, exactly. So here you have these two particular proteins. Proteins are made from genes, although that's wildly more complex than the evolutionist ever imagined.
Yep.
But proteins are made from genes, and so they figured, well, these genes are junk, so they're not going to do anything. Well, it turns out they do something. They make proteins. And these two proteins in particular, they are involved with the formation of the placenta, and two other related proteins are involved with the embryo attaching to the uterine wall, to the wall of the uterus.
Yeah.
Now, these are vital functions for reproduction, for survival of the species. Forget about the fittest. This is for survival of the species.
Yeah.
And so, Fred, these genes, were they supposed to have function?
No, they weren't supposed to have function. In fact, they claim that these things inserted themselves into the DNA.
From a virus.
You know, randomly just found, you know, by accident, inserts themselves into certain places in the DNA.
So they were useless. Virus-derived junk.
Yep.
Now, horizontal gene transfer among microbes, that happens all the time.
It's a design.
It's a designed feature to interact with the ecosystem.
Very complex. Try to evolve that. I mean, you try to evolve anything, but that is so amazingly complex.
Yeah, and that CRISPR tool that's now used for genetic engineering, which could be dangerous because even terrorists could use CRISPR. You could buy it for $1,000 on your kitchen table. You could start to mutate yeasts and molds and all this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's just amazing, and you could actually go online and buy this, the whole kit.
Yeah.
But at any rate, God designed microbes to be able to transfer genes. Our human DNA, God wrote our DNA.
Mm-hmm.
He wrote it in a book.
Yep.
When we were yet unformed, when we were a single-celled organism, looks just like a little sphere, our entire DNA is in there.
Yeah.
And what a brilliant job God did. And so the evolutionists say, well, this is all junk. Right. And so how does it go from junk to being vital for the survival of the species? How does that happen?
Yeah.
Remember we did that show in 2012 celebrating the evidence that the junk is not junk. It's all functional.
Yeah, that was incredible. And you know what? 4 years later, we've discovered even more. But
so
what was
much.
So amazing about that show, I remember that show,
yeah,
is because of a TV episode, and I remember it back before I knew you, back in the late 90s, 1998 to be exact, you had a debate with Eugenie Scott. That debate should be viewed by everybody.
Eugenie
Scott.
It's so
applicable today.
She was one of the world's, is one of the world's leading anti-creationists.
Yes.
PhD scientist. Yep. And so here I am, a Bible-thumping talk show host. And we have this debate. In fact, our producer grabbed a couple minutes of the audio from almost 20 years ago now with Eugenie Scott. And she was saying her best evidence for evolution was junk DNA.
Yep.
And I was challenging her on it. So in the show we did, which is easy to find, rsr.org/junk, you could hear about 6 minutes of that 1998 show. In fact, you could buy the whole thing
from our
store. You
can get the whole thing. I'd recommend the whole thing. It's,
yeah.
It's a great debate. The whole thing is.
Yeah, Bob debates an evolutionist, Eugenie Scott on junk DNA. We have it on DVD. We have it as a download. Just go to our website, rsr.org, click on the store, and you'll find the junk DNA video, and it's really fun.
That poor woman had no idea what she was getting into when you called her interviewed her.
And
she's probably
agreed.
Thinking it's going to be some unintelligent...
Bible thumping, which I was, a Bible thumping, now pastor. Fred, at the end of the 1 hour, she said, well, I don't debate. I think she knew it went badly.
Yeah.
Well, 2 weeks before, she was on a nationwide debate on PBS on TV.
Yeah.
So, but on Bob and Your Life, she said, well, I don't debate.
Yeah.
So let's listen to a couple minutes of this famous anti-creationist being asked by a Bible thumper, well, what's your evidence for evolution?
Could you begin, Eugenie, by letting us know what you believe are the three best evidences that show that new features have evolved in higher species?
I don't really know what you mean by the question, Bob. Actually, I want to finish off what I was starting to say when we had to break for that commercial. And that was when we were talking about evidence for evolution versus evidence for special creation. And I wanted to ask you about something called pseudogenes, which are sections of genetic material that don't have any function. If they were turned on, they would just put out gibberish because they don't have any, they don't code for any real proteins or any enzymes or anything like that. Why is it that you find pseudogenes that have exactly the same sequence of amino acid bases in closely related forms, but you don't find them in distantly related forms?
Eugenie, it took scientists a century to figure out what some of the higher structures in the human anatomy do. What do they do? Like the pituitary gland. It's somewhat conceited of us to say we fully understand genetics and we know that this material has no function.
If we are clever enough to be able to sequence a protein so that we know the exact order of amino acids and we know exactly what that protein does, that protein is not doing something else. It's not our ignorance. It's the lack of willingness to admit that this is a non-functioning protein.
Let me ask you a question. Do you think on the subject of genetics and what different genes and bits of information in the DNA code for and what they do not code for, do you think we have most of that knowledge or do you think we are still to gain most of the knowledge of understanding how genetics works?
There's a lot of knowledge that we still have that we still are learning about all the time.
Right.
But that's irrelevant.
That's irrelevant to
pseudogenes.
Eugenie, maybe we could set up a ground rule for every question of yours that I answer, maybe you'd answer one of mine.
Still trying to answer your first one.
Eugenie, do you think we have most of the knowledge that there is to possess about genetics, or do you think we're mostly still in the dark with the majority of the knowledge still to come?
Oh, I think we're over the hump.
Over the hump.
In 1998, Brett.
Yeah.
That's back when Dr. Douglas Axe was still at Cambridge, and they're trying to figure out how important the sequence of amino acids are for proteins.
Well, let me do the simple math. They're over the hump. She thinks they're over the hump, and they thought most of the DNA was junk.
Yeah.
And now like most 90, of the DNA, yeah, 90-some-odd 90 percent.
90-some percent.
I remember hearing
junk.
That.
Oh, yeah.
And now it's like, okay, maybe none of it's junk. That's quite the...
Right. They were over the hump.
Yeah,
that
over
was
the hump.
Conceited.
Yeah.
Conceit.
Yep.
Darwinism, we've given so many examples that Darwinism was a science stopper. Darwinism, evolution mm-hmm. is a science stopper.
Anti-science.
And so that this is just another example. These genes were not looked at for decades because they thought they were human endogenous retrovirus or HERV genes.
Yep.
And they were just junk, useless junk. You know, Fred, just the thought of male and female sexual reproduction, which we've talked
yeah.
about, every big hurdle evolution faces, like, how do you get male and female? How do you get the embryo to embed? What if the embryo doesn't embed in the uterine wall? Well, then mm-hmm. you don't have reproduction.
Yeah.
Every big hurdle evolution faces is an extinction level event. Everyone.
True, it is.
Over and over and over. Every vital organ. How do you evolve a vital organ? It's vital.
Yeah. Exactly.
Every big hurdle evolution faces is an extinction mm-hmm. level event, which is all just evidence that it's a make-believe
yeah,
story.
It's a bankrupt theory.
Yeah.
How about this next story about crocodiles that eat fruit? What about that?
No, come on.
A fruit-eating crocodile.
No, I can't believe that because, you know, the Darwin's red in tooth and claw, survival of the fittest. It's a dog-eat-dog world. And so... there's no way that these carnivores
yeah.
would be willing to eat fruit. Come on, Fred.
Yeah, eat fruit.
That can't
eat
be true
fruit.
Because the Bible says that when God created the earth, everything was very good and creatures ate only plants, even human beings.
Yeah.
We're vegetarians. So, but aren't crocodiles proof that that is all false? Aren't they?
Yeah, it's kind of a double-edged sword. Yeah, so it was pointed out in Science Daily, which is an interesting online website. These authors looked at 18 different species of crocodiles, and they range from the American alligator to the fearsome Nile crocodile.
Yeah, so they're crocodilians, some alligator, some crocodile.
Yep. And they found that 13 of the species consume some type of fruit, including a variety of berries, nuts, and grains.
Wow, berries, beans, nuts, grains.
Yep.
Yeah, so... even crocodile could eat vegetables.
Yeah,
that's pretty cool because that gives us a glimpse of Genesis explanation that originally it was all very good. And the word nefesh for soul is not mm-hmm. used for plants, but it is used for humans and for animals.
Yeah.
And so before the fall, before sin, death had not entered in. So there would not have been the death of nefesh, animals would not have suffered.
Yeah.
Now microbes could be killed and digested, and plants could be killed, digested, and so on, but not animals that have a soul. They would not have suffered. Hey, Fred, when I was a kid, I learned a poem about crocodiles.
Okay.
Have you ever heard of the author Ogden Nash? He did a short story. No, it was a poem called Professor Twist.
Huh.
I don't know
I don't,
if.
No, didn't
could,
see that one.
Could I share that with you?
Sure.
It has no function or purpose whatsoever.
Okay.
But here's what I remember, all right, from grammar school, which is what we called it in New Jersey. I give you now Professor Twist, a conscientious scientist. Employees say he never bungles and sent him off to distant jungles. Camped on a tropic riverside, one day he missed his loving bride. She had, the guide informed him later, been eaten by an alligator. Professor Twist could not but smile. You mean, he said, a crocodile.
You're telling me this.
Yeah.
I'm watching you do it.
Yeah.
And you've got this memorized. You're not reading that off of
anything.
So that must be a favorite poem that stuck in your mind.
Yeah.
Wow.
It just did.
You must have really liked the part about being eaten by an alligator or a crocodile.
Right.
I mean, you know, guys like that kind of stuff.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly. As like a 9-year-old kid is like, hey, that Ogden Nash, she's pretty
funny.
And
that just stuck with you.
Yeah.
You know, and it's funny, they talk about a cannibal deer, you know, deers that actually eat other deers.
Yeah, that's wild,
so, you know,
too,
it's
isn't
all,
it?
You know, from the fall, you know, because obviously that wasn't happening beforehand.
Yes, exactly. So, Fred, next story, I'd like to go back an issue. because you and I had marked, but in number three, volume 38, number three of Creation Magazine, the summer edition, there was an article that was very disturbing to me. And it's something that I am concerned about. I know we both are, about the creation movement going down yet another dead end. And it's the fountains of magma of the great deep. Do you remember the story I'm talking about?
Yes.
Yeah, this was discouraging because we have examples from Answers in Genesis and from down in Australia, Creation Ministries International.
Yeah, who does this great creation magazine.
That we love.
Yeah,
and we love Ken Ham and his Creation Museum and the Ark. I mean, I just can't wait to get to the Ark.
Yeah.
You know, when you got kids, it costs a bit to travel. Mm-hmm. So it might take us a while to get there. But, I mean, these are fabulous creation ministries. But they're subtly, I think, misleading creationists to believe that the fountains of the great deep, the source of the rain, that it was water, it was volcanic.
It wasn't water, it was volcanic, it was magma.
That is so discouraging to me.
It is.
It's like we're going down yet another dead end.
Yep.
And the creation movement has gone down its share of dead ends in the past. And I think now here we are ready to go down another dead end.
Another one.
Of how many years are the leaders going to be teaching people that the fountains of the great deep were volcanic when they clearly were not?
They clearly were not. From scripture.
Yeah.
And from tons of scientific evidence, too.
Well, sure. But if we could think of a couple of the dead ends that the creation ministry has already gone down.
Yeah. Well, the biggest classic probably of all of them was the canopy theory, right?
Oh, yeah.
And that is still around. Some people still bring it up and they're not aware that
the vapor canopy theory
has pretty much been rejected. Now, some creation scientists and some friends of ours still hold to some form of it. But it's largely rejected. I mean,
by all the creation ministries.
All the major ministries.
And one of the reasons is if the water came down from this vapor canopy theory that crashed down to the earth for the flood, well, let's say that could give you 40 days of rain, which it can't. It could only give you a couple inches of rain.
Yep.
But say it did 40 days. Well, Genesis says that the waters, the flood waters, continued to rise for another 110 days.
Another 110
after
rise.
The first 40 days of rain.
Yeah. So it stopped raining.
Yeah.
How is that happening?
But because the waters came from below.
Below.
It was the fountains of the great deep. So at any rate, for that reason and other biblical and scientific reasons, the vapor canopy theory has been dropped.
Yep. Yep.
There's another one, another dead end. And it's catastrophic plate tectonics.
And unfortunately, that one's still alive.
It's still
alive. It's on its death throes.
I think so. It's a dead end. It'll probably take about as long as the vapor canopy theory to finally die out. But I think it's showing the contortions that are diagnostic of a theory in crisis. Like that CPT appealing to an extraterrestrial moon. Remember that?
Yeah.
Circling the Earth six times.
Yeah, well, you went to the Wright Conference, right? And then that's where Baumgartner presented pretty much more miracles about this whole, to try to justify his CPT theory.
The plate tectonics-based theory of how the global flood happened and all that.
And even considered changing the order of the days. And I know that I think Danny Faulkner challenged him on that.
Yeah, because they were saying that the moon was created on day one.
Yeah.
Before day four.
Yep.
Which Genesis, God couldn't be more explicit that the sun and the moon and the stars were made on day four. So at any rate, the theory is in crisis and it's also another dead end. Well, now there's the magma fountains of the great deep dead end that we are going down. And we said we're going to give two examples, and these are very disturbing to me. An increasing subtle shift by the creation ministries is to suggest that the fountains of the great deep were volcanic, that they were magma instead of water. And the first example is an exhibit at AIG's Creation Museum.
Mm-hmm.
And Fred, we have a handheld cell phone video of this from the editor of our two big videos, the one on the global flood and the other on the evidence against the Big Bang. This is Tommy Stills.
Yep.
And in fact, you could hear his voice in this video. So let's play this and let's describe to the audience
narrate what's
what
going
we're
on.
Seeing.
Yeah.
All right. This is a video of an exhibit at the Creation Museum. I've been there a few times.
Yeah, great, great museum.
You've been there?
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
They show beneath the mantle magma rising up through the mantle of the Earth, getting to the crust, magma, and the magma going through the crust, and then fountains of water, steam jets, supersonic, going up into the upper atmosphere, and then the magma going out on the ocean floor is raising the water level because it's sort of pushing the ocean water up over the continents.
Yep.
That's the fountains of the magma of the great deep. That's not valid.
It's not valid.
Let's hear Tommy's question right here, where he is in somewhat shock at seeing this.
So does this mean like the fountains of magma of the great deep?
So that's amazing. It's a neat animation, but they're showing magma coming from the core of the Earth, not water. This is a magma-looking volcano coming up,
basically,
and then causing jet streams and, you know, to shoot up and cause the rain. And where's the extra water? Where's all the water you're going to need?
They're using
water that's already on the surface.
Right. They're flooding the Earth with the surface water.
Yep.
That's what they're doing. That's what all the other flood models do for the most part.
Yeah.
They flood the Earth with the surface water that's already there. They think you could have a global flood without adding water.
Yeah.
Like you buy something, it says just add water. Well, today, you don't add any water to get a global flood.
Yeah.
Which is not reasonable.
And I don't know how anybody can read Genesis and get this kind of idea in their mind about
not at all.
Volcanic magma as opposed
being the
to
fountains
water.
Fountains of the great
fountains
deep.
Of the great deep.
And Fred, these guys who promote CPT, they're good at computer simulations.
Oh, they're excellent at it.
Baumgartner.
Yeah, very well known. Featured in Time Magazine.
John Baumgartner and, a number of the scientists who do this.
Yeah.
Larry Vardaman.
Yeah.
They could try to use a computer simulation to see if you flood the bottom of the oceans with magma, are you going to get supersonic jets to dump, the Bible says, torrential rain.
Torrential rain.
The Hebrew, worldwide for 40 days. I predict that they cannot simulate that wouldn't even produce all that rain.
Yeah.
But then it leads us to the second example of this, not from AIG and Ken Ham, all the people we love there in Kentucky, but this is from Australia and Creation Ministries International and our beloved Creation Magazine, the very last issue. They have an article about volcanism, and it's a fun article. But in the middle of it, they say something that to me is distressing. They talk about volcanism.
Yeah, and in this article, they go right to Genesis 7:11 when they're talking about volcanism.
Yeah.
Genesis 7:11.
And it's also disappointing that they don't quote Genesis 7:11 and maybe verse 12. They just reference it, which is very subtle. So for the words extreme volcanism, that's magma, volcanoes.
Yeah.
Here's the verse that they're referencing from Genesis chapter 7, verse 11. In the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, the 17th day of the month, on that day, all the fountains of the great deep were broken up, and the windows of heaven were opened, and the rain was on the earth 40 days and 40 nights.
Yeah, they're reading a lot of volcanism into that verse.
The fountains of the great deep are not volcanoes.
It isn't.
It's
I would
not
have never
magma.
Thought that.
No.
How can you pull that out of that verse?
And so it's one thing to propose that plate tectonics is the explanation for the global flood, just sped up a million times. Okay, so you make that argument. But it's another thing now to suggest to Christians that the fountains of the great deep were volcanoes.
Yeah.
That is not reasonable. And I think as creationists, we need to push back against that and let AIG know and let CMI know that that is not reasonable.
Yeah, completely agree. It's a huge dead end again. And how long are we going to stay on another dead end?
Yeah, the creation movement has gone down too many dead ends. And now, because of the opposition to Walt Brown in the hydroplate theory, which is the only flood model that draws specifically from the text of Genesis chapter 1 and chapter 7 to explain where the water came from.
Yeah.
It came from the subterranean chamber, the water below the Rakia, below the crust of the earth. That's where the flood waters came from. So when the Bible says it came from the fountains of the great deep, we know where they're from because they were explained on day two of creation.
Yeah, and I guarantee you there's a lot of creationists out there who weren't aware of this. Sure, a lot of the scientists that are very, very deep into all this, they're aware of what's going on. But a lot of the creationists, they're probably amazed that they're actually saying it's magma, not water. You know, I know before I became real familiar with the hydroplate theory, I just figured it was water. Right. I never knew that the CPT theory did not include the fountains of the great deep being
water.
I always thought that was part of their model.
Right.
Yeah, this is amazing. This really is something we need to push back on.
So, very good. Fred, thank you so much for another fun show. I don't know, since I'm a co-host, can I say it was an awesome show? It's just so much fun.
It is. It's a blast.
To explore God's world that he created and see all the evidence for his hand at work.
And all the, you know, me being an engineer and just seeing all the engineers that are trying to copy his design, because his design is so, so amazing and so far beyond what we can do. And it's great that trying to copy his design and improve things.
Oh,
I just wish that they would acknowledge where they're getting their ideas from. They're not getting it from, you know, their own wisdom. They're seeing the design of someone else.
Yeah.
And give tribute to where you're seeing that from.
Yeah, give glory
saying,
to God.
You know, evolved. You know, whenever they talk about this great, these great designs, they'll always have to throw in the word evolved somehow. They got to bow to that God.
Yeah. It's just this obligatory gloss. They put some amazing scientific discovery in biology, and then they say, and isn't it something how that evolved?
Exactly.
It adds nothing at all to the understanding, to the research, to the discovery.
Yeah, and they just want to make the editors happy.
Yeah,
you know, Science or Nature magazine.
And so, Fred, last scientific point, when we talked about these supposed retroviruses being thrown by accident into our DNA, and now they're involved in the embryo implantation and the placenta forming, in fact. And the evolutionists think that this stuff happens by accident, and then it finds a function. And just imagine somebody taking code out of my Samsung Galaxy Note 7, just taking a, you know,
a chunk of code,
code and sticking it in somebody's IBM PC and thinking it's going to sort of maybe work.
Yeah. And that's amazing.
Is that ludicrous beyond measure?
It's ludicrous beyond ludicrous. I mean, I know right now where I work at Micron, we're working on taking this glava code and then attaching it in this other system. And there's an API that defines how they both
an
work
API,
together.
And there's a lot of engineers. Programmers interface, right?
And,
API?
Yeah. And there's a lot of work that's going to go into making that thing happen. You know, just imagine, oh, we're just going to put it in there and it's going to work.
We're going to just,
if we said that, first of all, it wouldn't work. And second of all, we'd be looking for a job.
Yeah, of course. Because
it's ludicrous.
Absurd.
It's absurd to the nth degree.
To have multi-layered, complex systems interacting with one
another.
Just
toss a piece of code over here and it's going to work.
It's going to fit in somehow and add some vital function.
Yeah.
It's embarrassing.
And let's not forget, too, that the DNA reads backwards and forwards and three-dimensionally. Yeah. So what about the code that's running the other direction on the back end strand of the DNA?
How awesome God's
how's
design
that gonna
is.
How's that going to fit into this whole thing?
Yeah. So
it won't. It can't.
When you reject the God of the Bible, you are willing to fall for anything. And this is the extent that thinking people will go to.
Yes.
Because they want to deny what is evident to everyone. Yep. Richard Dawkins says that biology is the study of things that appear to be designed.
Yeah.
Stephen Hawking says that the fine-tuning of the universe is obvious everywhere.
Yep.
And so they admit fully half of the argument that it all looks like it was designed, but they just hate God and they want to be immoral and they don't want to think that they're going to be held accountable by anyone and they're wrong.
Yeah. And Darwin's bulldog said that evolution allowed him to be immoral. I'm paraphrasing, but that's really what he said.
Yeah.
It's great. It's liberating. He said he did say it was liberating. For his desires.
So you could be
sexually
immoral and think you're going to get away with it.
Exactly.
And no one gets away with anything.
No.
The Bible says your sin will find you out. So turn to the Lord Jesus Christ and ask him to forgive you, and he will.
Yes, he
Everyone will. Everyone lives forever with God or without him, whichever they prefer.
Whichever they prefer, smoking or non-smoking.
Wow. All right. This is Bob Enyart.
And Fred Williams.
For Real Science Radio. May God bless you.